I guess my ramblings were being recorded for posterity. So has recording resumed?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody, welcome to the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency Special Board Meeting of Thursday, May 18th, 2023. Just a quick reminder on public participation. Public comments may be accepted in person or submitted by email. The email is vinagsapublic.comments@chicoca.gov. If you'd like to address the board at this meeting, you are requested to complete a speaker card and hand it to the clerk prior to the conclusion of the staff presentation, a time limit of 3 minutes per speaker on all items, and an overall time limit of 30 minutes for agenda items has been established. With that, we will go over to Linda Herman for the roll call.
Thank you, Chair. Board Member Reynolds?
Here.
Board Member Kimmelshue?
Here.
Board Member Cooper?
Here.
Vice Chair Royer?
Here.
And Chair Chusinski?
Here.
Thank you.
And with that, we will go to the special agenda. Item 2.1, potential reconsideration of the Vina GSA Board's approval of the final fee report regarding long-term funding for the Vina GSA. I had submitted my rationale in writing, so I'm the one who made this request. I will turn over to Cammie to give a presentation and an explanation of information.
All right. Thank you, Chair Tuchinski, members of the board. Cammie Loser, Director of Water and Resource Conservation for Butte County, and currently your GSA Administrator. So one thing to emphasize this evening, this is not necessarily new information, but rather looking at the existing data that we've had from a slightly different perspective. So based on conversations I've had with the public and with Chair Tuchinski, just really wanting to refine how we have been presenting some of the information so that it is clear to you all what we have done and kind of where we have landed today. So just keep that in mind. So it is information that has been in the technical memo, but it's kind of rewrapped so that it's presented in a different way so that you can digest it a little differently. Okay, and hopefully my thing will go, maybe. I know I did. There, all right, we're having technical difficulties moving the slides forward. So this, I will say that this presentation does cover all three board items. So there won't be additional presentations with each of those items. What we'll do tonight is review the activities to date. We'll review the uniform fee that you approved last week, and we'll provide clarification regarding the available data, the process needs and costs for the irrigated and non-irrigated fee option. We'll talk about updated cost estimates with that irrigated, non-irrigated fee option. Again, that's repackaging the information that was already in your technical memo. Also provide a comparison with Wyandotte Creek GSA's allocation. And the reason being is that they have taken the irrigated, non-irrigated approach and eliminated the uniform fee. And I thought it would be important to look at the fee that they're charging, but if we but under kind of Vina's budget and acreage, just to give you an idea of the differences. Also reviewing the state intervention fees. We've brought that up in the past, but we'll just talk about it again so that it's kind of there. And then review of the City of Chico and Durham Irrigation Districts Prop 218 participation in this Prop 218 and or their payment options on how they're going to pay the fees. And then an updated schedule, if applicable, if we do make any changes this evening, and then just a review of the options for reconsideration. So just as a review of the activities today, back in February, we reviewed the governance and the structure of the GSA and how we have funded the GSA to date and consideration of the options for administration. That was the meeting where we talked about having a program manager that would, the GSAs, the Vina GSA and Wyandotte Creek GSA would jointly fund at varying percentages. And that would be housed in my department in the Department of Water and Resource Conservation at the county. So the GSAs will be paying for that position. We had a special board meeting in later in February, which was more of a strategic planning meeting for the GSA. And then we did some revenue projections in March. And that's where we identified the costs associated with the GSA and confirmed the revenue needs for GSA administration, GSP implementation, and SGMA compliance. So reviewing and approving that budget that would be used for this entire process back in March. And then in April, you looked at the technical memorandum that identified all of the funding options that we were looking at, as well as options looked at, but essentially eliminated from further review. And then at your last meeting, we had the fee study and engineers report fee study that that looked at just the uniform fee option. And then we're here tonight at the special board meeting for potential reconsideration of that vote. So if we did nothing, if we just moved forward from here with the uniform fee, we would send the fee notice to all the parcels that are subject to the fee. We would probably get that out in the next week or so, but definitely by the end of the month in order to meet our timeline. And so that fee would be for the $3.09. We would hold a public information meeting on June 14th at the Masonic Center. Once landowners receive the fee notice, they might have some questions. We want to provide some general information for them. And then in July, we would hold the protest hearing and adopt the fee for the 2023-24 fiscal year. There was a little typo in your current presentation. So that's what would happen if we didn't do any reconsideration. Those would be the next steps. Just as a reminder, the uniform fee, we looked at the fee for a five-year budget, and it landed with a $3.09 fee. That would be the maximum fee that would be charged each year. We would look at our budget and if there's any rollover, make sure that we're meeting all of our goals with regard to SGMA compliance, and the maximum fee that we would charge would be $3.09. And we did talk about annualizing the fee and kind of averaging it over 5 years, but the $3.09 is what would be initially charged. And then subsequent years, it may be less than that. We might need less. And kind of see where we land from there, whatever's left over. Just to give you an idea of what that looks like, and there's a chunk of Chico of varying parcel sizes. So even though it's a $3.09 fee, it is based on acreage. So if you have a 0.41 acre lot, it's $1.27 per year. So emphasizing that that's per year, not per month. Depending on the size of your lot, like a 0.18 acre lot it's 56 cents. So just to give you an idea of what that cost would be.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Does the city of Chico have the ability to do that? I mean, calculate the size of the parcel and institute that fee?
Yeah, so what the city of Chico decided to do at their, when was I here? Last month sometime. I have the date in the presentation. They've decided to participate in the Prop 218, so they would not pay their member contribution. The notice would actually go to every resident within the city of Chico, and yes, that we do know the acreage for each of those parcels and the exact fee amount for each of the parcels within the city of Chico.
Thank you.
So, and that's
because it's account. We're doing it through the county property walls, and the county already has those, correct?
Yes.
So that's yes.
And we're actually the consultant Ludorf is preparing that assessor's role for the assessor's office, so we have that data.
So they're doing all the calculations.
Yes.
Okay.
And so this graphic shows you just what the cost would be for larger for larger parcels. So a 10 acre parcel, it's $31.39 up to, you know, 135 acre parcel, it's a $417 point with 58 cents fee. So just giving a larger range. It's sometimes easier to see when you see the size of a parcel. So with that in mind, looking at the irrigated and non-irrigated cost option, I did print out a larger map for you. It should be up there on the dais. One of the things we wanted to emphasize is that we do have the data to differentiate between irrigated and non-irrigated land uses. And that's kind of the crux of all of this. So during our discussions with through the technical memo, there was concern that we didn't have the data that where we could differentiate between irrigated and non-irrigated lands. And I've added a slide and I'll talk about that in a minute. But we do have the data. And we use that data also for our annual reports. It's how we calculate groundwater use with for the annual reports. And so that data is just based on the Land IQ data, and I'll talk about that a little more. The thing that we would need if we were to choose the irrigated, non-irrigated option is an appeal process, a policy and an appeal process. And the concern by this board and others was that might be extensive. We might get a lot of people appealing the fee, assuming that most of the appeals would just be based on perhaps the wrong classification. They're non-irrigated versus irrigated. We don't anticipate that there would be that many appeals each year, because the ag footprint or the irrigated footprint is relatively stable within the VINA GSA. So it's essentially kind of built out. And so there's not many changes expected. So, you know, we're all prone to error. So there might be some that are misclassified, and there would be a process put in place to address those that have been misclassified. And so, and again, the land use data is part of the database. So if we were to put in an appeal process, we could do that between now and when the actual bills go out or the tax bills go out in December, and we can talk about that more at a future meeting if necessary. So in talking about the Land IQ data that we have, so we have a total of 174,327 accessible acres within the VINA sub-basin. And we, just as a reminder, we're 93% groundwater dependent. So the irrigated classes or the land use classifications within the irrigated category include agriculture, so orchards and then non-orchards, other ag uses, the city of Chico, Durham Irrigation District, and the unincorporated kind of residential, commercial, industrial, and other similar developed land uses. And then for the non-irrigated classes, classifications would be rangeland, open space, undeveloped land, native grassland, and even dry land farming classifications. So this kind of goes to what Director Cooper had said, you know, when he was asking, can we use zoning? And this is better than zoning, because zoning is just a class of kind of an allowable use, where land use is what's actually there. So, and this table, so what we did is had Ludorf put together that map to just show the land uses, and then irrigated, non-irrigated, and then just showing some of the calculations for acres and the number of parcels.
So do you want us to ask questions as we're on specific topics, or do you want to get through it and come back?
It's completely up to you. Go ahead.
Okay. So I am a huge proponent of Land IQ and have been from the very beginning. What I'm concerned about is I think this is a misapplication of the data that they're providing. The reason I say that is I'm seeing parks in here that I know are heavily irrigated. I'm seeing golf courses in here. I'm seeing ski lakes that are indicated being non-irrigated when I know the ski lake is being filled with a large diameter well. I understand the process we're talking about in terms of somebody coming in saying I shouldn't be classified as irrigated. What are we going to do to clean up parcels that are listed as non-irrigated because of the satellite technology when actually what's happening on the ground is very different. For example, a dairy that's irrigating its pasture and feeding milk cows, or somebody who's doing some type of commercial production that has a large amount of water usage.
So I'm going to turn to Lourdes, who is online, because they'll know, from what I understand, that the information is also kind of reconciled with other land use data from local agencies, such as the county information. So Jacques or Eddie, if you wanted to speak to the land IQ data and the land use data that we use for the annual reports. And you should be able to unmute yourself.
I just add that could be addressed in the policy, whatever policy kind of accompanies, if this option were to move forward, that could be addressed.
I'm just questioning how that work would occur. I mean, I see a ranch here that's classified as non-irrigated, and I know they pump to restore wetlands, but it's coming out of the aquifer. Is that non-irrigated? Are we going to get into all those issues and how long is this going to take to reconcile these different situations? So I'm just tossing that out there. I understand that the satellite technology is outstanding as it relates to understanding kind of big picture what's going on. But when we're getting down to the point of individual tax rolls and who's paying what, I don't think it's fully reconciled.
Okay.
This may be the time while we're waiting for Eddie and Jacques to unmute themselves to talk about the fee addition for administration that was included. One of the things that our correspondence revealed was that we can now rely on that. So could you explain on that being kind of the max figure rather than a wild extrapolation? And that comes to, I think, this question, because that deals with capacity that we might have for the period of time that we need to do this.
Right. So what Chair Tuchinski is referring to is Table 5 in the technical memo identified the additional costs that would be associated with administration and or analysis of different data. So for example, what Director Rohr was just mentioning. And so the cost estimate that was identified with looking at and analyzing that data, perhaps for the first year, as well as some of the administration from the appeal process, was a 17 cent to 19 cents in a year 27, 28. That would be in addition to the fee that was identified. So in subsequent tables, I can show you what that looks like. And then I think they're trying to figure out how to get Eddie and Jacques on here. So what that would look like here in this table, it shows what the irrigated costs would be for using what would be the assessable acres under the irrigated classification, and then adding in that 17 cents to get the new amount that would be charged for irrigated. And so for the purposes, if you were to adopt an irrigated charge, the maximum charge would be $3.94. And then we would adjust that each year accordingly based on the revenue needs of the GSA. Okay.
Oh, good. Then I'll be quiet.
Eddie, I hear that you're available.
I am, yeah. So I guess the question was, we're utilizing the satellite data. It's not perfect. And so there's going to be areas or parcels that maybe don't get picked up by the satellite data, but there's, local boots on the ground knowledge that shows that, hey, these folks are utilizing the wells to, fill their ski lake or water their cows. I mean, we're just using the best available data. I mean, it's not perfect. So if there are areas that, we need to dive into a little, maybe refine them a bit more, I mean, we can kind of do that. I guess, big picture, how many acres is that really sort of total up to? I don't know. But we're not going to pick that up in the land IQ data. So that is a weakness of utilizing the sort of land use approach.
So Cammy, with the idea that we might need to do some modifications, that there might be some appeals, factoring in on the other side any capacity that your department might have, plus capacity that may be generated by this 17 to 19 cent fee, which I believe in your information is roughly $30,000. Is that doable? Or is the fear that we may end up with a snowball where it costs appreciably more, or suddenly Christina is taking a lot of her days to do this?
Again, just as Eddie was saying, the data isn't perfect. The extent of how off the data is unknown. I want to emphasize that the program manager, you know, once we have a program manager, one, we will not abandon that person if, you know, wash our hands and be like, it's all you, we're done, we're out. I think all member agencies would continue to provide technical assistance with that program manager. Obviously, if there's an extensive appeal process, we're going to step in and assist with in-kind services. I'm hoping that the first year it might be a little more of a push, depending on how off the data is, but also remembering that it is GIS based. So compiling the land IQ data, looking at it with the county's land use data, because you can get on the county's GIS map and you can look at a parcel and see its acreage and its land uses. So there can be that reconciliation between the two. So I can't tell you how many hours it's going to be. We do have on-call consultants, and Ludorf being one of them on our team, that we could utilize to just, that could be their job for a couple of weeks, and taking the GIS data and going through it and reconciling the differences between the two.
And finally, without getting into the weeds of what a policy might be, is the policy necessarily an annual policy, or is there a capability of having this initial review and then there's a blanket period of time that this might cover, either the 5 years of our, you know, that we have as plotted here on our plan, or 2 years? So in other words, in subsequent years, might this be less of a concern?
Yes, I would say yes. The policy would also identify if land use changes, obviously, significantly. Let's say if we implement the Extend Orchard Replacement Program, which is proposing that someone takes ag land out of production, or orchard land out of production for more than a year, it's maybe 3 years or 5 years, then they could come in and apply with a form to say, hey, I'm taking my land out of production, and maybe that might be part of the Extend Orchard Replacement Program policy, and we can incorporate it into our policy of then they don't pay as much. They could get a non-irrigated rate. That could be part of the policy as well. So we could look at that, those little nuances to be added to the policy.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I hope. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. I'll let you get back to the prepared numbers.
Hey, Cammy, this is Jacques. Do you mind if I make a few comments right now?
I do not mind at all.
Okay. So Ludorf, you know, we support the GSA and all the stakeholders and landowners here. And but I think it's important to be pretty frank about where we are. So we do a lot of work with GSAs in different parts of the state, but you guys are headed to be the first, and there's a few others in Northern California that may end up being the first few to go down the irrigated, non-irrigated charge option path, which I don't think is a bad thing. But I think this is one of the reasons why many GSAs have considered this but not gone forward with it, because one thing we've learned is that when you have a GIS aerial photography based approach to setting policy, you are going to miss things on the ground. And if any of you are familiar with the irrigated lands programs in California, they spend an awful lot of money. Eddie probably can remember some of the numbers, but you know, $3 an acre just on doing annual assessments and field checking to make sure they have accurate data about all the growers in the program so they can file compliant reports with the state. And so if you do go down the irrigated, non-irrigated path, it's not going to be perfect. You will have some appeals in the first couple of years, and obviously that'll be done as accommodatively as possible. So it is going to be a learning process. Like, it's not a fee that's established and proven anywhere. You guys will be proving it. But I think the important thing is to just ask yourself, if it costs a little more to implement, is this fee option the best for our customers? And if you guys really believe that, knowing everything that we know about the irrigated, non-irrigated option, then it's probably worth giving it a try. Because remember, let's say you do go irrigated, non-irrigated, you're not committed to that forever. If at any time, whether you were implementing a uniform charge or an irrigated, non-irrigated, or some other more sophisticated option, any GSA can reassess every 5 years, or as soon as they realize maybe an option wasn't the best option for their GSA. So I just want you guys to know that there will be some additional costs. There will be some field verifications required to get people properly billed. And we don't want to create an environment where there's a perception that if someone can easily get plugged in to the policy the right and equitable way, that there's any kind of legal concern. So we need to make sure we implement this kind of approach with very much high transparency and flexibility, I would say, because it will take a couple of years to probably get everyone properly classified. And there are shades of gray in irrigated, non-irrigated. We've talked about this with other GSAs, and it's really tough to say, here's the perfect definition, you know? And so we've worked with the program manager, you know, to come up with a framework so you as policymakers can understand, if we go irrigated, non-irrigated, what does it look like? How are our customers going to get classified? But no matter what definitions we put on paper, we're not going to get it right the first time. And so this is our concern as a consultant. Obviously, we want to set a fee that's legally defensible and is fair to everyone. And I think it just is the lay of the land, besides the additional costs that we enter into. But fundamentally, if this charge is better for your customers, all things considered, than say the uniform charge, and you believe that to be true, and it's worth a little extra investment to be more fair and more equitable to all customers, then I think you're in a good position to give it a try. I mean, you know, the worst case that happens is, and I think that's important to talk about, what's the worst case? We implement it for 2 years and it just doesn't work out like we hoped, or, you know, maybe the costs were higher than we thought. And so worst case is we have to establish updated fees before the 5 years comes around, when you'd probably want to reassess your fees anyway. So I think that's the worst case. So I just wanted to make a few comments, you know, at the policy level, so you guys have a clear kind of pros and cons and lay of the land as you make this decision.
You could always wait till WyanDot does it and then see how that goes. All right.
But just really quickly, is part of what Jacques was saying about being able to adjust, the fact that the max number for the irrigated, non-irrigated is higher than the flat fee, so we wouldn't necessarily have an issue of charging people radically more? Is that part of his calculation?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, he was mentioning that we would have the flexibility to change if we had adopted irrigated, non-irrigated. Is part of that because that fee is higher than the 309? And so then if we went back down to the 309, because we're charging people less than the max, is that part of what he was saying? Or is
he just... Yeah, I'm understanding.
Yeah, Let me just clarify. What I'm saying is every GSA tries to make the best choice for their customers about the fee option you think is best. And if you guys determine irrigated, non-irrigated is the best option, but it may not play out like you hope, I'm saying you're not stuck with it. You can amend it or update your policy so it works better for everyone involved. So that, I was just making the point that as you make this decision, because you guys would be the first ones to do it. And so, you know, there's pros and cons to that. It could work out great, or it could be, you know, more
challenging. I get that. Forgive me for interrupting you. I get that, Jacques. But Vice Chair Royer just asked if we would need a new Prop 218 because we would be raising the fees of the lower fee.
There's a difference. I'm talking about the structure of your fee. I'm saying if you go forward with irrigated, non-irrigated, as we've proposed, I think it's as defensible as it can be given what we know today. But all I'm saying is the other part of it is how it plays out. You know, it may not play out like everyone hoped. So you can always update the fee in the future.
But can we update the fee without another 218 is the question, or would we be starting this process again?
You would likely have to do a new Prop 218. I think the legal counsel's on the phone, but most likely if you're going to change the structure, in my experience, you would definitely have to do a new Prop 218.
I don't know if you want to add to that, Valerie, but she's on.
Yeah, no, this is Valerie. Thanks. That's right. And remember that if you did the structure, your notice would say you would have two different cost structures. So if you mailed your notice to an irrigated parcel, it would have one highest possible fee. And if you mailed the notice to a non-irrigated parcel, it would have a lower but max ceiling fee. So the minute you wanted to go over IOU, you know, if you have a two-tier system, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be mailing different parcels, same notice, but different number for your max fee based on your fee report. And then if you wanted to move either of those numbers or the structure for, you know, rethinking those or recalculating those, that would be a separate 218 process.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, that way we understand exactly what latitude we have to change if that's something we wanted to do. Okay.
All right.
Please go on. Thank you.
Not quite. I keep bouncing back and forth between slides, so I'm just going to move ahead. And if you want me to go back. So just again, showing what those fees would be applied to different parcel sizes. That's all in your charge. And then the non-irrigated cost would be $2.50 with that additional administrative cost per acre of 17 cents up to 19 cents. So, all right. So I'll say just for fun, I did, so Wyandotte Creek GSA is looking at only an irrigated, non-irrigated fee. They are not even considering the uniform charge. And not only are they looking at irrigated, non-irrigated, that's one option. They're looking at irrigated, non-irrigated, and charging surface water users and groundwater users differently. So irrigated surface water, irrigated groundwater, and then non-irrigated. But I'm not going to really talk about that. But what one of the things that they did do to alter fees for the non-irrigated rangeland owners was that they looked at a 90%, 10% allocation, where we have a different formula of how much of the GSA administrative costs were applied to the irrigated, and the SGMA compliance costs were applied to the irrigated. They use 90% of the budget would be applied to those, and then 10% would be applied to the non-irrigated. So they have an entirely different cost. Remember that the Wyandotte Creek GSA is a third of the size of Vina, so they have to spread that irrigated cost to fewer landowners. So their cost is much higher. But what I did is I took that 90-10 percentage and I applied it using Vina's acreages and for irrigated and non-irrigated, and it just gives a different cost. And so here you'll see that the maximum cost would be $5.08. And then for non-irrigated, it would be under a dollar. With the Wyandotte Creek GSA, they were targeting about a dollar for non-irrigated land uses. So just to look at it in comparison, this is what the cost would look like for VINA. And so here's a comparison of the uniform cost fee, the irrigated, non-irrigated, and then if it were a 90-10% split for how we allocated the GSA admin and SUGMA compliance costs to irrigated and non-irrigated as well.
So if my math is correct, looking at the acreage thing, you don't need to go back. It says what we can assess is 31,926 acres of irrigated and 3,622 non-irrigated acres. Spitball math is under this, if we adopted the plan that the Wyandotte Creek is, that 90% of our people would be paying significantly more to offset the 10%. Is that what I understand?
No. So
I know that it's a 90-20. It just happens to be coincidental that these numbers are 90-20.
Are you looking
at 90-10?
Acreage.
Yeah, I'm looking at acreage, right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You know what? I looked at parcels instead of acres. That's my fault.
Yeah. So so for example, if you look at here, the irrigated accessible acres, 98,894 irrigated acres is in VINA, and that would be the cost. Applying 90% of the budget essentially to irrigated land uses and 10% of the budget to non-irrigated.
I guess my point is that 90% of the parcel owners would be supplementing 10%, even if the acreage is different. So is that idea correct?
Oh, I haven't looked at the numbers in that way. It took me all weekend to go through the numbers.
No, I get it. I'm just diving into your numbers here. If we look at it at a parcel thing, which was kind of where my brain was, you know, again, the number of people that are going to be considering this plan, the number of individuals who would be responsible. I'm just saying that it looks like, again, 36, you know, into 31, you know, 3,600 into 31, 926. It's close enough to a 90-10 split for
I would probably discussion. Look at from a parcel. I see what you're saying now from a parcel standpoint. Yes, but I would look at acreage as a comparison. So there's 98,000 acres of irrigated and 75,000 acres of non-irrigated because that's what they're being charged on is per acre.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you.
All right. So just as a reminder, the state, if the state water boards were to come in, what they're really looking at is wells. So they would charge, there'd be a $300 fee per well. This excludes de minimis extractors, essentially residential domestic wells. For the $300 per well, the de minimis users or residential users would be charged $100 per well.
Per well per year.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And then with the, I'll just say ag wells or more commercial wells or large diameter wells, let's say that they would also be charged for use. So water use, and it's $40 per acre foot to $55 per acre foot. It just depends on what event kind of triggers our non-compliance with SGMA. And so, and then there is also reporting requirements for large diameter wells essentially. And so they will have to report their water usage to the state. So just, and it, this isn't, I'm try, not sharing this as like the threat that looms over the GSA, but just as these are fees that are allowed to be charged by the states to the GSAs. And again, as Christina would say and has emphasized in the past, that intervention is hopefully just a temporary measure. The intent of the state is that the GSAs, the local agent entity, would be brought into some kind of compliance and be able to charge some sort of fee and be able to manage itself as well as its GSP and be able to meet SGMA compliance. What would really pull us out of compliance is that we would not be submitting our annual reports. We wouldn't have the funding to be able to do the SGMA compliance of submitting annual reports, the update. Hopefully we don't have to respond to DWR with our GSP. They'll think it's great, but ultimately those are the things that would kick us out of compliance.
And one of the other expenses that would factor in because of this acre feet, that would need to be measured by a meter that somebody would have to install, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify what I thought was true.
All right, so just covering the how the other member agencies will be paying. So in April, I went to Durham Irrigation District and they're opting to just pay the their proportionate share of acreage based on whatever the fee is. So if it's a $3.09 fee, their amount will be $1,350.33 for their member agency contribution. If you were to choose an irrigated, non-irrigated fee, it goes up to $1,721. And hopefully my math is right. I'm looking at Director Rohr and my math might be wrong, but it's somewhere around there. And then so in May, on May 2nd, the city of Chico voted to have landowners within the city limits. They'll actually participate in this 218 and receive a bill as part of their tax bill. So, whether we charge the uniform fee or the irrigated, they're participating in it. So essentially that adds to the number of people that are, then the bill goes to. If you did, go ahead.
Sorry, real quick. Mm-hmm. And the Board of Supervisors, you know, Todd and his group didn't decide that they're gonna follow the Durham irrigation mode and pony up for my house, did they?
Well, no. You got to pay for yourself. So essentially, that's what the whole point of the 218, right? If let's say the county, we wouldn't be having this conversation if the county were willing to pay, right? So, but if the county were, then let's say then the city of Chico would have to do their own 218, or the GSA would do a 218 on the behalf of the city of Chico. So. I don't think the county wants to pay. All right, so our potential revised schedule, if you were to move forward with reconsidering what the uniform fee and wanting to kind of unwind things a little bit, we have this special board meeting today. What we would need to do is go back and update the fee report that was prepared. And then we would bring that back to maintain the schedule. We would need to bring it back by the end of the month. So May 30th or 31st, that's when this room is available to approve the fee report and choose what fee that you wanted. So it could be the uniform fee or irrigated, non-irrigated fee. And then the week of June 5th, the mailing of the public notice would go out with the fee amount that you have chosen. And then we'll continue with the informational workshop on June 14th. It'll be fresh in people's mind because they'll have just gotten their notice. And then we would have to adjust the protest hearing date to accommodate the 45-day notice period. So it would have to shift to July 26th and then stay on track for the August 10th date for submittal to the assessor's office with the tax roll. And I think, so your options for reconsideration is if you wanted to reconsider your approval of the fee report and consider the uniform cost, irrigated, non-irrigated cost option, or some variation thereof in the fee report. And to kind of clean things up, we would also recommend reconsidering your approval to develop the fee report based on the uniform fee option, and then changes to the schedule if necessary. So all three items on there.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Cammie. Before we open for a couple of public comment, are there any questions from my colleagues that haven't been asked already?
Yeah, my first question is going to be to Valerie Kincaid. And Valerie, I attended a portion of the Wyandotte Creek GSA when they were deliberating over this. And I thought my colleague, Bill Connolly, on the Board of Supervisors had a very good question. He said, we all use the water. We all need to protect the groundwater. Let's make this easy and do a parcel per parcel fee whether you're a half acre or whether you're 1,000 acre. And if you did that, the math, and if my math is right, if we're roughly, our budget's $500,000 and we have 35,548 parcels, it would be about $14 a parcel, no matter what the size is. To me, I think that's palatable. Now, the attorney there, I forget who the attorney was there, said that that is not appropriate, or we cannot do that. Do you share that same sentiment? You follow what I'm saying, first of all?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And I think you're saying that it would be a kind of per parcel rather than a per acre charge. And the only issue with that is that's not really a property assessment. It's more like if you own property at all. So I don't know if it would fall into a tax. I'd have to think more about that. But you run into problems with that. You know, we've had it where people say, can't we just charge everyone in the basin per person? And the problem with that is you could potentially, that could be a regulatory fee, but how to figure out who's going to come in and how to collect that is the issue. So, it's if you do a property assessment, which is the 218, and it's under the specific constitutional requirements of water service, which allows you to do a protest vote instead of a majority vote, then if you use that mechanism for voting, you are stuck with a per acre charge. And you can't do a per parcel charge, because the whole concept is you are being charged by the amount of property you own, not just okay. That you own it in general. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's more proportionate. So if we were to do that, that would require maybe an election, and you'd have to get 2/3 of the vote. Is that correct?
Yeah, if it's a tax, or if it's not, it would definitely be a majority protest if you could fit it in to not a property assessment, but some sort of other assessment or fee.
Okay, thank you, Valerie. Appreciate that input. I just wanted to make sure all you attorneys agreed with each other, which normally attorneys always agree with each other, so that's good. So secondly, I just wanted to say that I personally, and you guys know where I stand, I'm leaning towards the 90-10. And the reason for that is because I believe it has to be affordable to the landowners. And it's more affordable, even though I know right now orchard nut farmers are not doing extremely well, but it's more affordable for them to pay a $5, $6, $7 an acre fee than it is for someone who has a non-irrigated piece of land that is rangeland, where they may make $20 an acre, where an orchard farmer hopefully will make anywhere from $500 to $1,000 an acre. And coming from a farming background, I can tell you that $5 an acre to $10 an acre is basically a spray, or maybe even less, a spray on your trees probably costs more than that. So I think it's a fee that certainly the irrigated farmers are going to have to pay more. The irrigated landowners are going to have to pay more, but it's more important to them that they protect their groundwater, because without the groundwater, that land is not worth near as much as it is. So that's what I'm leaning towards. That's more of a statement than a question.
I have counterpoints to you, but I would like to give the public a chance. And again, I don't wholly disagree with you, but I think that there are some counterpoints to what you said.
So we're going to get into a big debate here tonight?
Oh, it's going to be arm wrestling.
Okay, that's what I figured.
Yeah,
okay.
That's why I'm sitting next to you.
Okay, good.
But I'd like to give the public a chance to comment, and there may be none, but there may be some. And then I'd love us to get back to this. So are there any people who have submitted? Oh, Toby, please. No, come on up. Thank you.
Hold on.
And we're checking it. We'll do a mic check with you first. And I won't take it from your time.
Oh, we have a fancy mic. Look at that.
There you go. Perfect. Great. Please. All right.
while I do some introductory, I'm going to ask
who visual aids.
Well, one's in tiny print and the other map is not great, but we saw this notice at the last minute, so we did our best to pull information together for public comment tonight. So, okay, my name is Toby Giesen-Tanner, and I represent AGBC here tonight. And I wanted to talk just a little bit, and I'm wondering, can we pull up on my PowerPoint at slide 9, it's the map of irrigated, non-irrigated?
Kind of like this map?
Yes, please, okay. Thank you. So I think I've spoken in front of this board and others before, and I always say I'm here on behalf of AGBC, but I thought it might help to explain that a little bit. AGBC represents about 60,000 acres of what in this would be considered orchard, mainly orchard crop. So when you look at the numbers, and as I was listening earlier to somebody talk about, we're talking about customers here. AGBC represents 80% of the ag customers. And so there's a bullet here that when you add the orchards and non-orchards, that gets you about 78,000 acres of agriculture. And AGBC represents about 80% of that. 80,000 acres of ag is about 80% of the total irrigated agriculture. So it's AGBC is about 60% of irrigated ag. It's a lot of acres. So when you look at all the green there, it's about 80% of all that green. So I just wanted to point that out. That's who, you know, AGBC represents a lot of farmers. We were formed in 2017 in response to the county saying, get involved, pay attention to Sigma, start representing your interests. We've participated all along in the GSA, the GSP, and the PMA, you know, the development of these different issues. And we've supported the process. And we're even participating in trying to find grant money and doing other things. So AGBC has been really involved, and it represents a lot of farmers. And I won't go into all the detail, but I've said this in previous meetings, and I'll say it again tonight. We support the uniform approach to this issue, and we're hopeful that you will as well. In April, the process decided to move forward exclusively on uniform. That has come back, and so we've been trying to look essentially at this point now for data to better understand what the irrigated, non-irrigated approach would look like. It came together quickly, so I appreciate that. We haven't seen the data. That was the first definition that I saw on the screen tonight of the difference between irrigated and non-irrigated. But we haven't seen the data, we haven't seen the definitions or what policy would be implemented. So it's really hard for us to even think about what that approach might be at this late point in the process. So I think it's important that we say that. We did our own analysis doing the legal beagle thing but we did look at, and this sheet here goes through every parcel, I think, of acreage in the Vina GSC that's not actively farmed in trees or rice, and it's larger than 100 acres, to really get a better sense of how is this going to impact different categories of landowners in that area to the east. And there's some key takeaways that I'll point out here, but I gave you all the data that I have. But I think there's a couple key takeaways. Number one, and this sounds loaded, and I don't mean it to be totally loaded, but it, you know, if the irrigated, non-irrigated goes forward in some fashion, if it's 88 cents or 250 or whatever that is, we end up, or it looks like it provides relief, and I'll say this, but it's out of county, folks, for the most part. There are some cattle guys, but most of it's out of county. And those are people that are holding land for long-term use, whatever that is. And I don't know how you craft a policy that excludes that type of person, because it's grazing land that's being held for a long-term say development purpose or other purpose. And so I think, again, this has come together quickly because we didn't expect it, because we thought we were headed down the uniform approach, but we did try to pull together our best kind of look at who these people are on the east side and what that really means, who we're really providing relief to. So anyway, that's what you have in front of you. Appreciate you, Toby.
If somebody has a question for me, I'm trying to respect our three, I need a couple extra minutes, but
I'm done.
Perfect. Does anybody have any questions for Toby? Okay, great. Thank you for the information.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Does anybody else wish to speak before I close? Okay, I will close the public comment. And I just wanted to respond to a couple things that you said, Director Kimmelshue, and they weren't, again, it's not a whole 180 degree difference. One of the things that I think we're doing is not necessarily selling our options, but at the end of the day, when we approve our options, we are going to be selling to the public an alternative. I crudely, to say it, which person would they rather pay, the state or the Vina GSA? And while there are people who do have acreage that may not get any charge if they don't have a well, for example, if there's one well on that thing, they're suddenly going to be in that category. They are, for all intents and purposes, then irrigated. And so I don't know that it's quite that clean of a comparison to say that we're making a strategic dollar figure for those folks. We also have to consider the likelihood of passing this. And if we jack up the fee to amount for parcels in Chico or parcels that are irrigated otherwise, are we serving the best interest of the broadest constituency? And is the broadest constituency going to support us? So those are just two considerations, perhaps against the 90-10 in our area. In that area, the Vina is different than Wyandotte in that we don't have surface irrigation to consider. We essentially are a groundwater agency, a groundwater area. Everybody is getting the benefits from this, whereas others may not. I don't know enough about Wyandotte, but because they're surface irrigated, that's a difference. So I just wanted to throw those counterpoints, not necessarily counter arguments, out to the discussion. And is there anything that anybody else would like to add before I do that entertain a motion thing?
I just want to say to Toby, my gosh, you put in a lot of work to put these together, and it does resonate that who will be paying that fee. I'll just say that. Thank you.
And I wonder, I heard the in county and out of county, and I just wonder, strategically speaking, how invested out of county people are to protest the fee, to be that concerned about the difference in the fee. I'm just, again, not having an answer, but just throwing that out there. That was what struck me when I heard the in county, out of county difference. So
yeah, let me ask Cammy a question, or Christina. I don't know if you guys can answer this. You know, I know most of Butte County and most of the Vina GSA area is the agricultural, I mean, the irrigated land is pretty much used up. Now, there's probably some non-irrigated land that could possibly go into an irrigated purpose, orchard, alfalfa field, something along that line. If we did go the irrigated, non-irrigated, and we found out that some of these parcels are now irrigated, can we change the fee? So, does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. And the answer would be yes, because okay. We would know that it's changed, because as we use the data, that's what we also calculate in to be used in the annual report. So it increases water usage, and we would be watching the consumption, right?
Would you want to add?
Christina's more
familiar.
Yeah,
I would just say the land IQ data is really honed in on agricultural land uses. So if it switched into a ag use, I think that we are going to have that data on an annual basis. We can catch that.
Great. Thank you.
Now, procedurally speaking, this motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
That's what I had a procedural. So if item 2.1 passes, then we drop to 2.2, And what happens if that doesn't pass?
Well, that would be an interesting conundrum. My hope would be that if we agreed enough that we were going to move forward with something different, in other words, an irrigated, non-irrigated, that there would be a contradiction in the very next thing. They seemed kind of related to each other. So hopefully we won't get to that point. If we do, then we might have to have another consideration. But like I said, to me, it's more of an administrative cleanup. From my understanding, it's not technically necessary to have the other one, but it just would be following legal format if we did. Valerie can contradict me if...
You have to take the two separate votes because you had two different groups of people who are voting in the affirmative. So
Okay. It
has been, the vote from the last meeting has been recalled because you had voted in the affirmative. You said you wish to reconsider. That may pass, that may fail. If it passes, then the question is whether Director Reynolds, Director Cooper, Director I wish to reconsider our vote on 2.5.
Again, Valerie disagrees with me on this potentially, but 2.2 is a subset of 2.1. It was a direction of how to move forward while we were doing the plan. If we were to do this on everything that changed its mind, every direction that changed during the iteration, we would need to revisit everything. Now, fortunately, our board hasn't done that. We've agreed for the most part. And when we came to the final GSB, I agreed with all the colleagues to support that. But if we had changed something that we agreed on in an earlier direction when we adopted the final GSP, we wouldn't have had to go back to the vote from 2021 or 2020 and reconsider that vote. I know Valerie may disagree with me on this one. I didn't get a final response from her because I think I probably tired her out. But to me, again, the second one is merely a procedural step that we took along the way. Okay. That if we all voted to reconsider the plan in a different direction than that original direction, we will have accomplished that, and this would simply be a cleanup.
Here's where I respectfully disagree. We now have a 90-10 proposal in front of us that was nowhere in consideration in any of the previous two debates or a part of our discussion with our
That's fair.
So. The debate was irrigated, non-irrigated versus uniform. And now there's an option that you do have to go all the way back to April to reconsider April to get this injected in.
With all due respect, you all overruled me in moving the plan forward where we might have arrived at the 90-10.
It wasn't even in discussion in April.
Well, the discussion in April was, should we move forward with considering both options and answer questions that came up during those options? And again, my motion died without a second, and I was the dissenting vote on moving forward with just a uniform option. Again,
90-10 wasn't one of the two options, though.
I understand. And yeah, well, and to answer Raymond's question, I guess we need to see what happens with the first one. And then then we might know what's going on. That may render the second one moot, the second item moot. And then we could deal with the problem if it comes. It seems to be the answer. And I would just, it basically would be up to me or Director Cooper or Vice Chair Royer to make the motion to reconsider. What I would like to hear, if it's okay, she certainly doesn't have to answer, but it would certainly help inform my thought process if I understood what the thought process of Director Reynolds might be representing the city of Chico.
So I've got a lot to say, but I go back to what our consulting group said. Is this what's best for our customers? And we would be the first person to do this. I've been setting policy in Chico for about 5 or 6 years now, and we really suck at being the first to do anything, to be quite frank. So that scares me a lot. So I'm leaning more towards the uniform until somebody can completely convince me that somehow we magically are going to become really awesome at being the first and leading at being new at something. So that's right. That's where I'm at right now. I'm not open. I'm open and I'm hearing what Mr. Kimmelshue's saying, and I totally understand where he's coming from. I'm just not sure that I can go back to saying that that's what's best for all or the majority of our customers, while I do have a lot of empathy because that is such a hard area to make money in and to, you know, add another fee onto it. That's tough. But I know our nut guys are struggling right now too, and market's bad everywhere. So anyways, that's where I'm kind of sitting right now.
Great, thank you. So do either of my colleagues wish to reconsider the decision at last meeting?
I don't.
That's fine, and I don't have to, okay. And after hearing the bulk of the information, I am not gonna move to do it either. Again, I especially appreciate the input. It has no disrespect to Director Kimmelshue. Really, as much as I say this, we disagree, but we can disagree agreeably. I wanted to hear the new information. I wanted presented, and also with the five of us who are gonna be voting in July. If the five of us in July, one of the things I asked the last meeting, it was our first 3-2 vote that I can remember. And I had to ask if there was a supermajority required on that vote. There will be a supermajority required in July. And if we don't have at least 4 of the 5 of us on board in July, then this whole thing becomes a moot exercise. And so I had wanted to keep the variable on the table as something to consider once we had fully vetted information. We have. And so I'm not gonna move to reconsider. And so I think that now stays where it is and our schedule stays on track where we are.
Yep.
Okay, I also respect everyone's opinion here, definitely. But I do believe that we should all be at the June meeting when I believe that we will have some folks that have spoken with me, which are true livestock men and women, not people that are looking to develop their land anytime soon, and some that are in the Williamson Act and will be there for years, and some that have placed their land under easements, so it will never be developed. These are people that are making their livelihood is the livestock industry, which is very difficult. And especially if they have to pay that much on a per acre basis, it's gonna really cut into their bottom line. So I respect everyone here, but I think we all need to be there and stand up for the decision that we've made.
If we are willing to, if we're willing to change the date of the meeting, absolutely. I'm gonna be in North Carolina. So again, I've said this before.
I will be out of town as well. And I said it at our last meeting.
Yeah,
I do
What's
have the alternate. Date? I do have an alternate that would be happy.
What's the date?
Yeah. June 14th is the date that we've scheduled and for this meeting, for the workshop. So if we're willing to change it, that was the only thing. That's the only reason why I interrupted you. So please.
Can I ask one more question? Is there any other option that allows you to actually pull out cows? Like, can we say it's instead of irrigated, non-irrigated, it's everybody except somebody that owns a cow?
Or somebody who's under a permanent.
And last time I checked, you can't own a cow in the city of Chico. So I don't think they can go get a cow and get an exemption for that. Like, is there another matrix that's not a 90-10, that's not a whatever, but you're this or you have cows or you have these, you know, particular thing. Is that a thing?
Well, I think ultimately we would just drill down on the land uses and if what they're actually being used for, if I'm understanding your question correctly, like we would really look at the land use and classify, get into different details as to what is being, the land is being used for.
Because I'm not opposed to doing some sort of a you know, split thing, but as we're hearing right now, it sounds like our orchard guys and gals are okay with this uniform type approach. So maybe it goes from the 30 whatever to the 350, but these ones go down to the 50 cents or 88 cents, or I'm just throwing out numbers. I don't know.
And that could be something we look at in the future, maybe in 5 years when, if we wanted to revisit the fee, depending on where we are with the implementation of the GSP, the grant money that we get and where we are in terms of compliance. And making, you know, if we're meeting our interim milestone goals or trending upward, we might look at a different way to calculate the fee, and we'll have even more data than we do now.
But during the five-year time, it would be the uniform.
Yeah.
And we will, and I think this has happened in other parts of the state, we'll send out this information, people will look at it, maybe they'll throw it in the garbage can and won't look at it. But one thing that they will not throw in the garbage can is when they get their tax bill. And then they're going to see how much more they have, and then they're going to start attending our meetings. So we better have a very good explanation as to why we're doing what we're doing, whether it be the Horning property or whether it be the Foster property. They're going to be here and they're going to not be pleased. And so we need to have an explanation to say, look, this is why it's good for you. We're protecting everyone in the basin, and we need to have a very good explanation for that. And so that's just something to think about to the future.
I think you have some good skill in that, because this is, and I'll explain why. I'm not being flippant about it. You being essentially as county being a department of the state is used to unfunded mandates. And here we are with an unfunded mandate. And the alternative is, that's why in my mind, that's the alternative, us and the state. And so that's, again, maybe a simplistic dichotomy, but that's kind of where we're at. And so I think we need to make a case, not only of the benefit that you're talking about that we may be giving, but also that this is the alternative, and here seems to be the most fair way to go about it. Without upping the cost so much for X, Y, and Z. Just to clarify that if we were to charge, 88 cents an acre to some folks, people in the city would be paying $5 an acre. It goes up $2. So it is a somewhat of a significant, even though it is a smaller parcel size, that is going to be a factor. So,
but they're living on a quarter acre, so it's $1.25 to them.
It's
so
not I'm not a big deal,
but worried about the city of Chico as I am.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Chair Chasinski, you bring up a very good point. And I think just another thing for you guys to do, but we need to have a side-by-side comparison as to, this is an unfunded mandate. This is something that state of California says we have to do. We'd rather have local control than have the state of California telling us what to do. Here's what happens if the state of California takes over. Here's what happens if we do it locally. We have to do this. And then also on the other thing, we needed to be able to defend our $500,000 budget. Because I've had some questions on where in the world does all the $500,000 go? And of course I didn't have the budget in front of me. So I was, couldn't answer that, but that's, and because it's 500,000 at Vina, I don't know how much the budget is at Wyandotte, right? It's what?
It's about half.
Okay, half. And then what will Butte be?
Well, Butte.
We don't necessarily. Butte's a different animal.
Different.
And we don't know if we will be, and we, meaning the county, will be running Butte. So it's a $750,000 bill, basically, to hire one person. That's where they look at it, to run this organization. But obviously we know that that's not the case. There's other things in the budget. And we need to be able to have something we can hand out to people and say, this is what the $750,000 is going to be used for. I'm sorry, we just need to be able to defend what we have done.
I totally agree with where you're coming from. Something else has struck me. If you think back 3-4 years ago, and we took Butte County and we divided it into three different sub-basins. And we even then took M&T Ranch out of Vina and put it down to Butte because it seemed like it was slightly more homogeneous with layout down there. We ended up with a basin that, from an agricultural standpoint and having a large urban center, it made sense. We also now have this strip on the other side of 99 that is mainly rangeland. Well, the alternative would have been, we could have taken that strip of rangeland out of Butte, Wyandotte, and Vina and made it its own GSA. And they would then have to figure out how they would fund running their own agency, which no matter what, there are basic requirements that under the state law, not Butte County, under the state law, they were included in SGMA. The boundary line was drawn over these ranches. They would have had to form, we could have called it Ridge GSA of Butte County or something. What would that cost for them to administer? $250,000, $300,000, even with minimal pumping going on? And they would have had to spread that out. So,
yeah, let me ask one real quick question. And Vice Chairman Rohrer had a very good point. So we did not draw these boundary lines. The state of California drew these boundary lines. We separated them into three distinct sub-basins. Okay. So these, okay. They didn't care whether it's range land or whether it was irrigated orchards.
Yeah, particularly the east side boundary, right? We didn't touch that boundary. That was defined by the state as part of their bulletin 118 groundwater sub-basins. And that was defined before Sigma came along, and there was kind of this regulatory world, right? And so it was more from a hydrogeology, you know, groundwater standpoint. But I will say, if you carved out the rangeland and they were their own GSA or sub-basin area, what happens is they prioritize, right? They have high priority basins, critically overdrafted basins, low priority basins. Low priority basins aren't subject to Sigma. So if you carved out that east side, you know, strip, likely it would be a low priority basin because they're not using groundwater. They don't have population dependent on groundwater, et cetera. And it would just, so that is kind of part of the dilemma with that space there, I think. Anyway, just to clarify.
Is it too late for them to carve it out? If those landowners wanted to carve it out, could they?
So I think that has, and maybe Valerie or someone else can speak to this on the west side. That's been part of their conversation, right? When they first got their fee and were like, this is really expensive for us. One of, I think, their considerations was, okay, well, let's move the boundary. And I don't think that's gotten very far.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. The DWR has specific times that they open up the Bulletin 118 basin boundary adjustments. And I think they opened it up, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, and then they closed it. I just looked on their website a couple of weeks ago because this question came up again, and there's actually no date that they're going to reopen that. And even if they had reopened it, the question on the west side, we took kind of informally to DWR. We obviously didn't get a formal review, but they basically said, listen, we think there's connectivity or there could be with this land, which is why it was originally in the Bulletin 118 boundary. And we really think you don't have the technical information, and we don't think there could ever be technical information to get them out and have them written out of the basin boundary. I'm not saying you couldn't do it. And frankly, if I were in those rangelands and owned those rangelands, I would be bothering DWR about it all the time. So it is possible, but we've heard from DWR two things. One, that there's no date that they're going to open back up the opportunity. And then two, that the technical information they think is a pretty high bar.
Well, if they do separate, what do you think, Director Reynolds? Thistle Ranch GSA? So I believe that concludes our business. Synthesizing our discussion, do we want to move the date of that workshop to accommodate the two directors who would be absent from that? Or are we going to, is there a reason to stick with June 14th?
We weren't going to advertise it as a meeting where it requires a quorum and just have the workshop format. I would, you know, if you wanted to be there, it's great. Then you can be the shield, but I think we got it. We can.
No, I don't think we need to move it. Okay, yeah, we can handle it. Yeah, we'll be there. I think we can justify why we've done things. It's just going to be very, and I'll say it one more time, it's going to be very difficult for certain landowners. But I guess that's just life. So
I will say that we will be recording it on Zoom because there will be presentation information, and we'll have that so that we can post it on the website as an informational item. And then Raymond, you can send your alternate.
And this is, sorry.
Sorry, Valerie, please.
No, that's okay. I don't want to interrupt you, but it would be really helpful for folks who are thinking about protesting or challenging the fee to come and explain why. I personally have heard a lot of these arguments because in other basins, there are similar, if not the same issue. And some of the issue here is that
people aren't paying attention, and you know, exactly what was explained about, you know, a lot of people paid attention in other basins, and then the protest came, and even after that, people were upset. So, I mean, there's a lot of outreach. Folks should know about this. If they have a better way to do it, if they have a reason why it's not a value of service to them, come and explain that. If you want to talk about the budget, great. I mean, and I it might sound crazy that I'm inviting people to come and beat the board up, and I don't want them to beat you up, but it's really important that they come and talk about this and have a discussion about why they believe that this is not the right cost for the service they're getting. Without that information, frankly, there are fewer choices. And frankly, it's going to be, you know, more defensible if people come and explain what they're talking about. If they don't come and explain and everything goes by them and they just want to throw rocks at it after it's already done, that's not terribly helpful. So I would just encourage anyone who wants to come or ask questions or ask about recalibrating the fees, ask what service they're getting and why it's calculated that way. We should be robust in welcoming those people now.
And I know that I'm not the only one, so I'm not singling myself out here as any different. I'm meeting with a couple constituents this weekend. You know, I know that we all get the outreach, so we're doing some of it individually, and then hopefully this meeting will help. And you know, don't give them my cell phone number, but feel free to give them my email if they get really upset with me. So we're going to stay with the June 14th, and with that, seeing nothing else, we will adjourn the meeting. And thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Thank you.